On a Wednesday, it is an hour of pocketbook issues here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Do you have an offer to live and work overseas? Have you accepted an expatriate relocation package from your company amid the pandemic? Or maybe you're just exploring new work opportunities that will take you to a different country. We will look at the financial implications of these new life chapters as we dive into your pressing money questions. Have you worked abroad and aren't sure about the rules relating to earned income? What do you want to know about saving and investing as an expatriate? Also, is your family looking to hire a nanny as an alternative to a daycare center? What do you want to know about nanny payroll and taxes? We're at 800-642-1234. Keith Poniewoz is Director of International Advisory Services and a financial advisor with Wachner Condon Financial Advisors in Madison. Keith, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Thanks for having me. I'm pleased to be here.
Well, starting with the basics, if you are a U.S. citizen and you're earning money outside of the U.S. or working abroad, do you file U.S. taxes?
In fact, you do. Now, there are a couple of exceptions to having to pay U.S. taxes and how that all works. But one of the things that we frequently see is people take contracts, particularly young people, as teachers. They want to go and teach outside of the U.S. for a couple of years, and they don't realize that because they're making money as a U.S. citizen, no matter where you live in the world, you're required to pay file taxes, not necessarily pay them. So they have to make sure to file.
And you worked as a teacher abroad, is that right?
Yeah, I did. I taught French in France for English in France for a couple of years. I was a French professor before I became a financial advisor. So that's how I sort of developed this niche. And I was lucky my dad was an accountant and so could provide me with a lot of this information.
That certainly helps to have the family accountant in your back pocket. Yeah. But my guess is you found quite a bit of nuance there as you worked abroad in trying to figure out how you navigate this while you're a U.S. citizen.
Yeah. The big one is that people should be aware of is if you're working outside of the United States, the U.S. does have something called the foreign earned income exclusion. And what that means is if you're primarily outside of the United States, working outside of the United States, living outside of the United States, basically $107,600, rough, give or take, in next year, it'll change ever so slightly, is exempt from U.S. taxation. But you still have to file. And so you can, you know, say you're making $50,000 USD, the equivalent, you still have to go in and, you know, file your taxes, put in that you're taking that foreign earned income exclusion on that amount of money, and then, you know, go forward. But you will, you know, have to pay taxes in the country you live as well. Most countries take that directly from your paycheck, but, you know, some countries vary.
So is double taxation then a real possibility?
In certain cases, yes, but I think it gets exaggerated.
Okay.
Because the U.S. has tax credits and tax treaties with many countries around the world, so for income tax, double taxation, if you make more than that $107,600 USD and you live in a higher tax jurisdiction, for instance, you can basically take tax credits for the taxes that you've paid on your income in that jurisdiction. Obviously, I'm not an accountant, but you know, you should consult with an accountant on all the details. But those tax credits will generally mean then that you don't have to pay tax in the United States. You can offset any owed tax in the United States with those tax credits. Where you get into trouble or where you have issues is sometimes countries have taxes that are different in structure than in the United States. One example may be something like a wealth tax, where they may not tax you on capital gains, or they tax you on capital gains. And if you've accumulated, you know, significant savings, they'll tax you on that. And because the U.S. doesn't have a direct wealth tax, you can't offset that in the United States. So that's where sometimes those taxes come into play.
Wow, taxing you on your savings, that would be pretty remarkable here in the U.S. where we're trying to build up savings. We're talking about pocketbook issues this hour. Our guide is Keith Poniewoz, a financial advisor from Madison. You can join in. Have you worked abroad and aren't sure what you should know about the rules around the money you've earned? What can you tell us about your situation? Have you found alternatives to childcare recently, and it involves a nanny. What do you want to know about nanny payroll and taxes? Join in at 800-642-1234. So, Keith, what should U.S. citizens bear in mind about their credit history and how that works overseas?
Yeah, that's a real issue, especially if you're, you know, moving abroad, and that you may have a U.S. credit history, but you may not have one, you know, wherever you're moving to, and you're looking to establish, you know, a credit history, and perhaps maybe if it's a longer term relocation, buy a home. There are certain employers will, for instance, provide you with, you know, a loan to purchase a house outside of the United States, because they're aware it's a little bit more difficult. But it is a major issue, and finding a bank now with increasing regulations that will work with Americans is frequently a problem, and one that people may not think of. So unfortunately, what in many cases, the easiest way of finding a bank is when you get there. And then generally the banks that will work with Americans are bigger multinational banks rather than, you know, smaller. If you're accustomed to using a credit union, you know, the credit union equivalent or things like that. So that's one of the frustrations that many Americans abroad face, is banking and building up that credit history and finding a bank that will work with them.
Should you hang on to your U.S. credit cards?
It depends. For how long are you going? If you're going to be here in the U.S., you know, for a you know, back in the U.S. in a year, yes, hang on to your U.S. credit cards. Generally, in those cases, less than a year, most banks are understanding of that. You know, they know you're going to be gone for a year and move back. But if it's a permanent move, if you're breaking ties, holding on to those U.S. credit cards can be difficult, because many banks, because of know your client rules associated with the Patriot Act from 2001, in many cases no longer want to work with you if you're located outside of the United States. And so you may have to give up your U.S. credit cards.
What about investment accounts? If you have investment accounts here in the U.S., what should expats do about those?
Yep. Generally, there are a couple of brokerages that will still work with Americans around the world, depending on the country and the direct citizen situation. Charles Schwab will work with many Americans outside of the United States, as will Interactive Brokers. TD Ameritrade, E-Trade, some of the other brokerages, it'll depend on where you are. They're a little bit more limited. Interactive Brokers will generally work with you wherever you are. The good news is, because of those tax treaties, that generally, if you have an IRA, if you have a 401k, those will generally be protected as pension plans under the tax treaties. So you don't have to worry, because you move to another country, that you are going to be hit with tax on those accounts, for instance. With your brokerage accounts, other sorts of accounts, every country is ever so slightly different. And so you'll want to get some guidance. The European Union now has passed some recent laws about, you know, the investments that they will let you buy and sell while you're resident in the European Union. And one of the other things is that if you move outside of the United States, change your address with your broker and they accept that, mutual funds will generally be prohibited. So there are lots of complications out there. Mm.
Financial advisor Keith Ponywaz is tackling your money questions all hour long. What happens if you suddenly get sick? How do you prepare financially for battling an illness? How do you explain a gap in your employment when you're talking with a prospective employer? Join in with your financial questions, your situations. It's 800-642-1234. Back in a minute with Keith Ponywaz right here on the Ideas Network. You're with us for a conversation about money issues here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. How do you stay out in front of medical debt during the pandemic? And if you get behind on medical bills, will it end up in collections? Kaiser Health News reports federal regulators will not penalize health systems that donate or sell unpaid medical bills to charities that pay off that debt What does that mean for you and how you negotiate with a creditor? Join in with your questions, 800-642-1234. Financial advisor Keith Poniewoz is our guide to your wide-ranging money questions. He stays with us. So, Keith, let's spend a moment here on medical debt. Even when you do have a job, can it be difficult to stay up with those medical bills? What should people do if they absolutely cannot afford to pay those medical bills?
That is a real good question, and one that, you know, is, as we know, one of the big causes of bankruptcy in the United States. One thing that we always suggest is when you're the easiest thing to do in these situations is to sweep it under the rug and pretend it doesn't exist. And so what we generally recommend whenever anyone is facing a difficult situation is to try to get out ahead of it as much as possible by reaching out to the hospital. Many have longer-term payment plans that they'll work with you to structure. Many may help you forgive those debts. And then the other thing is to look into, do you have alternate sources of funding to help with those, other sorts of options with that. But generally in these situations, you know, it's easier for everyone involved if you reach out ahead of time or as early as you can. Obviously, very difficult to do from a hospital bed. But if you have family members involved, to try to negotiate as soon as possible to say, hey, we need a payment plan.
It's especially difficult, I would imagine, too, when hospitals and physicians' offices don't necessarily disclose the cost of procedures. And so that is difficult, too, for the patient.
Yeah. And it's frequently a frustration that people have when they're going into the hospital is, you know, what does my insurance cover? What tests am I getting? What are the costs of those tests? And, you know, there are also variations of, you know, if the insurance will pay this amount and the test costs this amount, you know, there's a negotiation back and forth with between the two. So yeah, it's a very difficult situation. You know, one thing to consider is that as much as possible, if friends and family are involved, to try to make sure that a line is open during a medical procedure where you have contacts within the insurance company that you're working with to try to, you know, solve these problems in advance.
So communication is vital. Communication is really important.
Yes, I think in all of these situations, and that's one of the difficult things of the healthcare system in the United States is you're in a situation where you may not be able to communicate. You may, you know, be in tremendous pain or, you know, not with it. And so hopefully you have a friend, trusted family advisor, you know, someone that can help you in these cases to make those calls and decisions. And I think this is a case where a lot of financial planning doesn't actually have to do with money directly, but also setting up and establishing people you can trust in situations where you might not be able to handle these things. Particularly, you know, we see it with older people. If they're starting to suffer from dementia or things like that, having a limited power of attorney with someone who can help make those decisions for you when you're not in your right state of mind is something that is relatively easy to do, relatively inexpensive, but a lot of people don't do it or don't think about it.
We are exploring tips on life, tips on investing, saving with Keith Poniewoz. He's a financial advisor in Madison. You can join in with your questions specifically on childcare. Have you looked into hiring a nanny as an alternative to a daycare center? What has your experience been like? What questions do you have about payroll and taxes? We're at 800-642-1234. Keith, let's look at nannies. And, you know, not everyone is able to afford a nanny, but not everyone wants to send their child to a daycare center, which is also very expensive form of childcare. So when you are deciding to hire a nanny, what should you think about in terms of paying that nanny?
Yeah. So one of the important considerations and with this is as well, one of the things that we've talked about too, some of our clients and some of my colleagues have looked at is something like a nanny share, where you're not fully responsible for employing the nanny the whole time, but maybe you have 2 days a week, somebody else has 3 days a week. And if it's someone you particularly trust, that works fairly well. One thing that people often forget is that when they hire a nanny, they become an employer. And so with that, there becomes taxes to pay, payroll taxes. And so generally, if you're hiring a nanny to do it all properly, you need to file and hire or set up an employer identification number. It takes a couple of minutes online, and then withhold for the employee payroll tax. You may also want to look at some liability insurance for yourself if it's not covered under, for instance, your homeowner's policy, and also, you know, some liability, disability insurance, which you'll also have to pay unemployment insurance and things like that to the state. You may want to look at some of that for your employee as well, your nanny. But, you know, the other thing that people in these situations, and I think of this as an insurance kind of action. And one of the things that we have forgotten about insurance is that in many cases, it's a pooling of risk. And so one thing that I think in the pandemic, it's made it really hard for people to get together and cooperate. But if you're in a situation where you're working with a bubble of people who you trust, to look at an old concept, one I grew up with, something like a babysitter's co-op, where it's systematized. Maybe there are four or five of you that live on the same block and trust each other in terms of, you know, everybody's doing the right things in terms of, you know, preventing the pandemic, and setting up a collaboration where, you know, on one family will be on call on Monday, one will be on call on Tuesday and Thursday, and you'll be on call on Wednesday and Friday. And so if there an emergency arises with childcare, you can look to, you know, drop the kids off elsewhere. And I think thinking about insurance as a group of people, in that way, you know, divides it up. And that's one of the things that, you know, in defraying costs, the more people you can get involved, it always helps.
Spreading out the costs. Yeah. So when you look at the costs of a nanny, basically you have to look further than just that per hour that nanny is making, because once you start thinking about taxes and insurance, that cost is going to add up.
Yep, exactly. Many times, and you want to make sure that you don't get in a situation. I remember this from the 1980s where 1990s where people had nannies and they paid them under the table, and then they went to, be nominated for some position in the government, and they got in trouble, and that's because they weren't paying those taxes and paying attention to those taxes, and so it's something that many people don't think about.
Are there any tax breaks that you're eligible for if you have someone on your payroll, if you register that nanny with an employer identification number?
There are some. It'll vary depending on your situation and you know, things that you can look at, and then, you know, as well how you handle that. That's a really good question, and one I think people should talk to their accountant about if they have an accountant, or to speak out, do a little bit more research, because they'll vary depending on your situation.
And then in terms of developing a co-op source for childcare, or, you know, people on your block, how do you set that up monetarily? How do you negotiate who's going to pay what so that nanny does get paid if everyone is pitching in a little bit? How do you? Yeah.
You know, there are lots of solutions. I've seen now that there are apps available for babysitting co-ops. When I was growing up, it was much less high tech. I think they had little cloth dollar bills that they traded around for credits. But, you know, a shared Google spreadsheet or another spreadsheet that everybody shares that they can track, and then, you know, you can work through and confirm and carry that out at the end, you know, with sharing of online documents. That's another option. But yeah, there are apps out there. You can, you know, be as high tech or as low tech as you want in those questions.
Let's bring in Johnny in Menominee Falls. Hi, Johnny.
Hi. Hello.
Hi. What's your question?
I have four daughters, and they're all in their 30s now. And I was one of those. I didn't, you know, was pretty frugal, and I didn't like toys and clothes when they were growing up. So anytime we had birthday parties or when they were born, I asked for savings bonds. It's time to cash in those bonds, and I understand the online cashing in thing. My question is, I'm going to dump the savings bonds into, I believe, a checking account so they can pull that money into a Roth IRA. But I don't understand the tax consequences of pulling those bonds. Do they have to pay taxes on them when we cash them out?
All right, great question. And we're going to pause there on the answer of cashing out savings bonds, moving to an IRA. Financial advisor Keith Ponywaz is tackling your pocketbook issues, pressing money questions. You can join in with your questions, and we'll get an answer here on the other side at 800-642-1234. We'll be back for more personal finance right after this news update. Stay with us here on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Just a heads up on our programming plans this week. Join us tonight at 8 for live NPR coverage of the Democratic National Convention from Milwaukee. A mix of virtual, some live events. They're underway. We bring you up to speed and a recap tonight through tomorrow night, starting at 8. That's here on Wisconsin Public Radio. Right now, we're talking about financial pressures. Do you care for someone with special needs? What do you want to know about financial planning for your family? Are you trying to decide whether to refinance your mortgage right now? What questions do you have about that? Join in 800-642-1234. We have financial advisor Keith Ponywaz as our guide. So Keith, we heard from Johnny, who is cashing in savings bonds, wants to move those to an IRA. How do you do that? And what tax implications are there?
Yeah. And first of all, I want to say great work from Johnny for doing that for her kids. This is great. And now that they're, financially stable, hopefully they're going to get this nice little contribution to their lives and to help out. So that's fantastic to hear. One thing about, United States government savings bonds, you are liable for the tax on the interest. So the principal amount of the bond won't be taxed, but any interest made since she's had them will be taxed. It'll be taxed at the federal level. You won't owe any state taxes on those. So there will be some tax implications there that when she cashes them in, she will have to pay a little bit of tax. And those are taxed at your federal income tax rate. The other interesting thing that she's talking about is moving the money into a Roth IRA. And there's no tax charge in terms of moving the money into the Roth IRA. What she does need to confirm, is that she's going to gift these to her children. If she's giving more than $15,000 USD to any of them, she won't owe any additional taxes, but she will want to file a gift tax return that she's giving this. Generally, it's just a notification to the United States government that you're giving more than $15,000. It will be deducted from your lifetime exclusion amount, which is about $11.2 million, which not many people worry about in this day and age. But you do still have to file that tax form. And then with the Roth IRA, there's a limit, a contribution limit, and an income limit. So as long as the children are earning less than that income limit for contributions, and, she's not contributing more than $7,000 in a year, the only tax you'll have to pay is tax on the interest at the income tax rate. So one thing that you may want to look at too is maybe the kids aren't ready to cash them out, is to gift the bonds to the kids directly, and they can hold on to those still and wait until they need the money to pay the tax on it.
Okay. And so when she cashes those in, it looks like she's transferring the money to a checking or savings account in the meantime in order to then convert them to opening a Roth. Is there a way to do it directly? Do you need to do that middle step?
Generally, yeah, that's the easiest thing. in this day and age, you can deposit, for instance, the savings bonds now with a custodian. They'll digitize them, you know, and this is something else that a lot of people may not know. If you have old stock certificates that you haven't digitized yet, many firms will now take those. You know, you can go into the office and say, hey, I've got these old stock certificates. Can I put them in the quote unquote digital vault now instead of in my safe deposit box? So if you have a brokerage account somewhere, they may take those and digitize them for you. And then from there, you can move it to a Roth account. If you go into the bank, you go into the credit union and you cash out there, you know, you may be able to just take the cash and move it directly into a newly opened Roth IRA. But generally with, you know, in her case, it sounds like maybe her kids have existing Roth IRAs or are going to want to open Roth IRAs. And so she'll want to, you know, look at making sure that the cash is in a holding position while they get that set up as well.
Ooh, you're talking about relics of the past, paper.
Yes, yes. And, you know, it's something actually when you deal with elderly clients, they in many cases have stock certificates squirreled away in safe deposit boxes that they haven't realized that they had or that they got, you know, and have kind of forgotten about. And a lot of what we do as financial
advisors.
What
do they look like? I've never seen one.
You've never seen a stock certificate? They're beautiful. You know, they have that kind of ornate 19th century artwork on them. You know, very fancy lettering. In fact, you know, some people, you can now go on like Etsy or eBay and buy decommissioned stock certificates as decor.
Art. Yeah.
You know, Disney has really cool ones because they have Disney characters across the top. And a lot of parents in the 60s, 70s, 80s would buy, you know, a stock certificate for their child in Disney and then put it up on the wall as decor.
I love it. I love it. Well, I want to switch gears here and talk about families who have a child with special needs. And there can be a lot of challenges right now amid the pandemic, as we've seen the shift to remote learning. And in some cases, all of that from, you know, the healthcare to the daily, you know, therapies and education, all shifting home. So I'm wondering what if, you know, if you have private insurance that doesn't cover the full cost of their care now, what should you be doing?
Yeah, well, here in Wisconsin, there's a great program that a lot of parents with special needs children aren't aware of called the Katie Beckett program. It's through the Department of Health and Human Services here in the state of Wisconsin, and it will help parents with special needs children cover the gap between private insurance and, you know, additional costs for medical care, therapy, things like that. And a lot of parents aren't aware of it. And it's they have an excellent website, very worth checking out. Something that, you know, parents should definitely look into, because, you know, as you mentioned, caring for a special needs child is really expensive and really difficult from a time perspective. And so it's something that parents should look at. Even if they have private insurance, the Katie Beckett program here in the state of Wisconsin will help cover some of that gap.
What should we know about setting up a special needs trust to help protect your child's access to government benefits, you know, after you're gone, after you've died?
Yeah. And this is a conversation not a lot of people like to have, the conversation about what happens if I die. But a special needs trust is important for parents with children of special needs, because the rules of Medicaid as such are that they will spend down assets before they allow you to go on Medicaid. So you may leave your special needs child with some money to help defray costs. You know, they may not be able to work on their own or handle things on their own, or they can work only part time, and you want to make sure that they can afford everything. And so what we recommend, and most financial advisors recommend, is to set up a special needs trust, which essentially keeps the funds for the special needs child out of their name, leaves them eligible for Medicaid benefits, but also gives them access to some of the money. With that, you appoint a trustee who will handle the money. That's the other concern that many parents of special needs children have, is what's you know, who's going to help them manage this money so that it doesn't all go away, or it, you know, doesn't just sit there and is used to help them. And so you appoint a trustee with that. They can then disperse income to the special needs child as needed. The other thing that's really important that people often overlook and don't think about for children in general and special needs children in particular is making sure you find and appoint a guardian. Because if you don't specify that, it can be a real mess for the kids and, you know, for the whole situation. So in, you know, part of financial planning is communication and thinking about who you want to help should something happen to you long-term with the care of your children as well.
We're talking with financial advisor Keith Poniewoz, and we're looking at investing, saving, money questions through the hour, taking your questions at 800-642-1234. Keith, let's look at mortgage rates and refinancing. We have just gotten the news that there's a new lender fee that will be as part of Fannie and Freddie. And so I'm wondering, is this a good time to refinance?
I would say definitely still a good time to finance because we're seeing much lower mortgage rates than we have ever in the past. But in every case, what you're going to want to do is look at the total costs and talk to your banker, talk to a lender, a mortgage broker, whomever you feel comfortable with, and get an estimate. And one thing that I'll say as well is many people don't shop around on their mortgage. And it's something that we recommend in these cases to shop around. It's your biggest purchase in most cases, most expensive asset. And so to look and speak with a couple of lenders and see what they're offering, what their bottom line is in terms of what your monthly cost is, how long they're going to, you know, finance for, what's your mortgage rate, what are the upfront fees and charges. But with interest rates where they are currently, we've seen a lot of people be able to take their existing loan and refinance and get a shorter term or lower monthly payment, even with, you know, the fees and charges.
So there will be those upfront fees, but when you refinance at a lower rate over time, that's going to really add up and help you.
Yep.
And so, you know, when you look at the housing market now and you're going around shopping for rates, are you looking at, should you be looking at 30-year fixed rate mortgages or 15-year? What should you shop around for the best deal?
Well, generally the lowest interest rate will be at the 15-year or the lower the term, right?
Okay.
But everybody's, you know, financial situation is different, and you're going to want to find what fits best for you in the long term and what your goals are. If you're 15 years from retirement, you know, you may want to look at refinancing to a 15-year mortgage, for instance.
Financial advisor Keith Poniewoz is our guide to saving, investing, breaking down tricky money situations amid the pandemic. What investment questions do you have? What do you want to know about how to save up for an emergency? Are you prepared to dip into savings? Still time for your personal finance question, 800-642-1234. Back in a minute on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Let's get back to our conversation now with financial advisor Keith Poniewoz. He's helping us sort through a range of pocketbook issues from managing money, working abroad, to preparing for a difficult rest of the year and joblessness that could extend well into 2021. Let's take a call. Kathy in Pewaukee is with us. Hi, Kathy. Hi, Kathy. Are you there? And I don't think Kathy is there. How about Steve in Wausau? Steve, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Hi.
Hi. Just a quick question. I've seen some advertising now about special rules for Social Security, how you can increase it. And I remember years ago there was something about if you took it at 62 and then you changed your mind a few years later, you could pay back what you've taken and start drawing at your new age. Are there any things out there like that right now?
Keith, yeah, go ahead.
Steve, I'm not familiar with the specific advertisements that you refer to. Generally, we, with Social Security, the best thing is to not get it yourself in a situation where you're paying it back to gain more. And to generally, the rules with Social Security are the full retirement age has delayed a little bit. And so what we generally recommend is people look at, when they draw on their Social Security to delay for as long as possible, because it's a guaranteed 8.5% return per year in terms of the increase if you don't draw until at least your full retirement age, and delaying until at least 70. So not familiar with the specific advertisements. And I'm always, I will say, there is a lot of stuff that goes on for seniors around Social Security and so on. So hopefully, don't make any decisions based on billboards is my other piece of advice there. So that's the considerations with Social Security.
Steve, thanks. Let's try Kathy again in Pewaukee. Hi, Kathy.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I was just calling because my mom had been disabled, and one thing we found for her that might be helpful to other people was WISPACT in the state of Wisconsin. It was a way to set up a trust for her, put some money aside for her that she could use. Of course, when she passed away, anything that was additional left over did go to the state because she had been on Medicare. But it is just a way to put away some money for somebody who might have special needs or disabled. And the other is some of the veterans benefits that go unused. There's one called aid and attendance, and it's for helping to pay for the difference between what a veteran can afford and can't afford for like in-home care. And that's a great benefit. It's really only able to be used by people who served during the time of World War II, the Vietnam conflict, the Korean conflict, and some other wars. So it's just something to tuck away because it's for the veteran and their spouse.
Yeah, so resources are out there, but you really need to check, and something may be very much applicable. Kathy, thank you so much for those resources. We're almost out of time, Keith, and I want to ask you this last question because there's a sea of financial advice out there, but what is your best tip for us? What can you leave us with?
Yeah, and I want to thank Kathy for mentioning WISPACT. It's a nonprofit organization, and I had forgotten to mention that when I was talking about special needs trusts. Great organization and does a lot of good, so thank you, Kathy. And I think Kathy also points out the advantage of, banding together and joining groups that can help these conversations. Being the child of accountants, I received a lot of financial advice. And, I saw that a lot. I like to joke that I had to double entry bookkeep my allowance as a child. But, the biggest thing I think is the best people with money, the best investors, and obviously life, comes in the way, but they're the people who establish a plan and they stick with it. And what that means is, making sure that you are saving and sticking with that plan. And even though, for younger people, it may be, you want to get an extra fancy latte every day. Instead, pay for, don't get the whipped cream and save that dollar because those add up over time. I think people think that the path to wealth and financial security is overnight. And so I think that's the biggest thing is that it's going to take time and it takes establishing a plan and sticking to it. And then, as your situation changes to adjust that plan, but make sure that you're the one adjusting it as much as possible, not, not your animal brain, as it were, that wants a new car or a new boat or, those sorts of things.
Keith, thank you for joining us.
Yeah, my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Keith Boniwaz is Director of International Advisory Services and a Financial Advisor with Wachner Condon Financial Advisors. Now it is time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Brad Kohlberg with a story about a new song. It's called Milwaukee Strong.
The city of Milwaukee recently declared July 24th Milwaukee Strong Day, encouraging residents to remain united in the face of dual crises, the coronavirus pandemic and systemic racism. The centerpiece of the day was the song Milwaukee Strong, which features more than 30 local artists. Milwaukee musician Sean Hinton wrote and produced the track.
I'm the guitarist for Mary J. Blige. I've been playing with Mary since 2004. I had the privilege of also working for Jill Scott, John Legend, Jay-Z, and Lil Wayne. We are the proud,
we are the true. So how did Sean first hear about the project?
May 26th, a good friend of mine by the name of Kevin Suker texted me. He texted me like, need to talk to you. You got a minute?
My name is Kevin Suker, and I'm the executive director of 88.9 Radio Milwaukee. And the mayor's office called and said, got something we'd like to ask you. And the executive director of Imagine MKE, which is another amazing nonprofit in Milwaukee.
We have Louisville, Kentucky, and the mayor, they did a song called Lift Up Louisville, and they challenged us to do one.
So I called Sean Hinton, who is an unbelievably talented guitar player and writer and producer.
This is kind of a big deal. Like, it's nothing like writing a song for yourself, but it's another thing to write something that could possibly represent who we are as Milwaukeeans. Now, keep in mind, we're fresh off of the heels of the Miller Coors shooting that claimed the lives of 5 employees there, then the pandemic happening, and then we had to deal with the civil unrest with George Floyd dying. It was weighing heavy on my heart. I needed to do something. From the ashes and the dust. I cut the song here in my living room. Be Free cut a song with her and her husband's studio. I shot my video here at home, and everybody else, you know, they did their exact same thing. I didn't want to focus on the negativity of what was going on, but I definitely wanted to pay attention and shine a light on, like, you know what? Yes, we are dealing with difficulties right now. You know, there are difficult days ahead, but I want to be able to go out and dap you and like, yo, we good, fam. It's love. It's all love. No hate, no negativity, no negative energy, no nothing. Milwaukee strong like black coffee, yeah. Milwaukee black and brown, so please change policy, yeah. Milwaukee less work or ended poverty. Milwaukee growing, let's make sure that we grow it properly, yeah. Milwaukee home, so let our love show. Milwaukee special, invest in the homegrown. Talent, we all searching for balance. United, the good lands approaching all of our challenges. Every day, in every way, in every way. If we're always conscious and aware of what's happening around us and we're not on autopilot, I think that moving forward, the city will start to really, really demonstrate unity, complete unity. I do.
Sean Hinton is a Milwaukee musician, and he wrote the new song, Milwaukee Strong. It features more than 30 local artists. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook. I'm Brad Kohlberg.
And this is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to the Ideas Network.